Hi, today is January 24th, 2015. This is Mobile News Podcast number 107. And today, John Westfall and I have a very special guest, my good friend Warren Luz, who has a very sad but hopefully good story, a story that has a happy ending. But we'll learn about that more in a couple of minutes. But John and I wanted to start with a couple of comments on the various announcements that came out of Microsoft this past week. And Warren, please jump in if you have any thoughts on these things. Number one is Windows 10 Technical Preview 2 Build 9926. John, any thoughts? Do you care?
So I took a look at 9926, and I was, I think the operating system is slowly recovering a little bit from the Windows 8 kind of debacle that looks horrible if you don't have a touchscreen, and or it just seems weird if you don't have a touchscreen.
Yeah, it's unusable.
But I'm not a particularly big fan of the way that the live tiles are still kind of being pushed onto us when they're not that useful if you can't actually reach out and touch them.
Very, very true. Basically, they want a Windows phone on a really big screen.
They do, and Windows phone on a really smaller screen isn't working out all that well in the market right now, so I don't know why Windows phone on a large screen is supposed to do better.
Hey, it had a whole 3% of the market or something like that. But, okay, now, speaking of really big screens, something else they announced along with Windows 10 Technical Preview number 2, say that three times fast, is Surface Hub, which is, what is that, 70 inches, 78 inches? It's huge.
So it's interesting when you just put Surface Hub in, I did a quick search for Surface Hub, and yeah. Microsoft has got a little bit of a problem in that they named an app Surface Hub.
No.
So if you go just do a search for Surface Hub, you get a link to the Microsoft, Windows, application store. Right. And it's this dinky little app that lets you customize your Surface tablet. It's called Surface Hub. And one of the screenshots features the feedback form that lets you tell Microsoft about what you think of the dinky little Surface Hub app. Okay. And then the second link actually has this giant, beautiful looking thing that I think Microsoft actually wants us to know about, which does look very nice and beautiful. But again, Microsoft, with their impeccable talent for branding, unique branded names, in this case, a professional or a technical preview or a consumer technical edition moniker might have helped distinguish these two products.
Yeah. So Surface Hub is a giant, well, like you said, there's two products. One's a tiny 55-inch display, and the other one is something like 78-inch display. That is basically the old Surface table gone vertical. So instead of laying down on the table,
up on a wall.
Yeah. Nobody knows the price. I'm going to guess $20,000 for the big one, by the way. And I'm predicting that, one of our mutual friends, John, took some umbrage when I said this was an aspirational product that was laughable at best. Because the only people that are going to be able to afford these are the Fortune 5. And since Apple is one of the Fortune 5, that leaves four. and three-letter federal agencies. That's about it.
And all of them may have already invested in competing products that are largely marketed to the education sector.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, things like smart boards and things like that already let you do the sorts of things that Surface Hub demos or shows us we can do. So I'm not exactly sure what the benefit of a giant Microsoft Surface Hub is when you can get a smart board set up and hook it up to any laptop, anything you need to project, and get pretty much these same abilities.
Well, it does have cameras, but it is also $20,000, and I don't think the electronic whiteboards are, generally speaking, close to that price, unless they're, you know, like 40 feet tall. So,
no, and you can buy some cameras and just stick them on there if you want. So.
Okay, the next one is kind of cool, but again, I think it's aspirational. That's HoloLens. HoloLens. I got to pronounce that correctly. I almost said HoloLens, which is a whole different thing. So,
this is an interesting one that I think has slightly better better promise than the Surface Hub. But again, I have no idea if what I'm seeing on Microsoft's kind of infinite scroll webpage is actually going to be anything like the real experience once you strap this thing to your head.
Yeah, I suspect this is one of the things you really literally got to touch and feel and see for yourself, and it's hard to make fun of until after you do. But we'll see.
Yeah, and you know, it's one of those things that you can hope you wouldn't actually make fun of, but I don't know. Yeah. Microsoft is a company at sea right now with some of these products. And,
but you know, I gotta say, I do love virtual reality products, so I really want to see this one, you know, make some traction somewhere. I don't know where, because again, it's one of those things, something that anybody can afford quite yet. Okay,
I really think virtual reality should make traction somewhere, given the interest in it over the last few years. Things like Oculus Rift and. Yeah. Other products. I just don't know who's going to come out the winner in this whole virtual field.
Yeah, it'll be somebody surprising, I'm sure, you know, like AOL.
It would be surprising if AOL could come out the winner in anything. Yeah. But
okay, now speaking of winners, Windows RT, one of my favorites. You know, I said some very nice things when Windows RT came out, and I've had to eat my words over the last couple of years. But it looks like Windows RT is going to bite the dust soon, because apparently there is no Windows 10 update for it.
Was it you, or was it one of our mutual friends that called Windows RT the Kin tablet?
Oh, that was me.
K-I-N. Yeah. That was you. Yeah. I thought that was a very good, pithy observation about Windows RT.
Yeah, for those who don't
remember. Kin of Microsoft tablets.
Yeah, before Microsoft bought Nokia, for those who don't remember, they actually did make their own phone. It was called the Microsoft Kin, K-I-N, as John just said. And it lasted, 6 weeks in the market before they pulled it? Maybe 5 weeks.
At least six. Yeah, I think it was at least six.
Yeah, it was probably the shortest Microsoft life cycle ever. Okay.
I just remember being at a meeting with you where they gave us chargers for our phones because we were running out of battery power. All the chargers were Kin branded because apparently they had a bunch of those just lying around after the Kin got pulled.
Oh, boy, that was a very sad, sad time. Okay, now the final Microsoft story before we get to Warren's truly fascinating story, and I've been waiting to hear this whole story for several months now, I think. It's something I think, John, you and I will both find interesting, as I did, is that Microsoft just bought Revolution Analytics, which is a company that has commercialized the open source R statistical programming language, something you and I both use. But here's what I really found interesting. I just learned this today. Although Revolution Analytics started up in 2007, so it's not that old, it has a bit of history because its CEO is Norman Nye, who co-created SPSS in the 1960s. I think you're an SPSS user, aren't you, John?
I was an SPSS user. I try to avoid using it as much as possible because I see people in my field doing truly horrible things with it and not what they're doing. That is a completely different day. So I go to great lengths to discourage them from using SPSS and all possible lengths, but I do see it quite.
Yeah, you know, for myself, you know, since I'm much older than you, I used SPSS way back in the 1980s, and it was already old back then. It was already in, must have been 20 years old. Yeah, 20 years old back then, because I think SPSS the company started in 1968. So, you know, this guy's been around a long time. It's sort of interesting that Microsoft bought the company that he's heading. Okay. So that's our Microsoft roundup from a big Microsoft Newsweek. And now I want to introduce my friend Warren Luz, who's I have known. Let's see, how long have we known each other, Warren? Our kids were like second grade when we met. So,
wow. Second grade.
Yes. So that would be like 12 years ago, I guess, or pretty close to that.
Every bit of it.
So Warren wow. has Warren had a fascinating story. He mentioned to me, boy, when was this, in December, early December, Warren?
Maybe even a little bit before then.
Okay, so...
it was around that time.
So the short story is, Warren had disastrous hard drive failure. Now, you know, for most of us, that's very bad, you know, like for anybody else. But in his case, he had what, maybe terabytes of photos that he had gone through Aperture or whatever it is he uses to modify his photos. Mm-hmm. And like you say, well, he should have backed up. And that's where it gets interesting. So he did have a backup.
Right.
Warren, why don't you tell us what happened exactly? Because, you know, most of us think of people who go to these disk drive recovery services, people who have everything in one little drive on their notebook. Something bad happens, and they're in panic. Mm-hmm. You know, they've never done a backup. They don't even know what a backup is. They think they may have a backup, but they, you know, made a copy in the same drive or something crazy like that. This is not you. You had actual backups. So why don't you give us the background of, first of all, what your backup scheme was, and then what happened?
Okay, so I use CrashPlan, Drobo, and Time Machine.
Okay, so...
And go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, so you're basically doing everything right. You have a cloud backup somewhere off-site with, CrashPlan. You have a Drobo, which is a multi-disk redundant system. And then use Time Machine, which is an automatic backup. So it's something you don't have to think about.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Please continue.
Okay. So the story, there's always a prelude to a story. So the drill went on Fritz. Okay. On that, I have my iTunes library and probably about 3.5 terabytes of information. So I know not to get into trouble type of thing, so break out data rescue 3, and after Drive Genius could not rebuild the draw, and I was thankfully able to get data offloaded. Well, that data went onto numerous hard drives. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 hard drives in my desk along with the Drobo. Thankfully, I was able to get the data off of.
Okay, so Warren, can you tell us a story from the beginning? Your backup system looks like prior to the hard drive failure? Because you were not the kind of person who didn't have anything. You have all kinds of backups. So why don't you tell us what you had?
Yeah, I use a CrashPlan, a Drobo. Mm-hmm. And then Time Machine, and have used that actually for quite a while. I've been having a problem with my iMac. It's about a 3-year-old system, throwing out the external drives, inappropriately ejecting them.
Oh, okay.
And that was happening a lot with the Drobo, right? And it kind of fried the Drobo. I could not rebuild the drive, the Drobo, but I was able to get data off of it. So take off the data, put it onto numerous other hard drives, et cetera, and then I was able to use Drive Genius to fix the Drobo and get things going. That was actually pretty scary because I have a very large iTunes library, and it's like, you know, trying to reconstruct this. So it certainly got my attention around things and that the Drobo was vulnerable. Get that chugging along, and one day I'm working on my computer. I have my own photos for the screens on the computer. Also, I don't have my pictures. I have the default stuff, and I'm like, "What's going on?" Mm. And I cannot load any assets into Aperture. Well, the issue in moving all this data around was that I have a very large Aperture library, about 6.5 gigabytes of data. And I had put that onto a Thunderbolt drive so I could let my hard drive breathe on the Mac, and it would be fast and spiffy and do all my photo editing, et cetera, that way. I'm trying to figure out, okay, maybe Thunderbolt, which is where the Aperture library was living, was not able to do that. Hmm. I think at that point I called you. You're like, this is not so good. It's like, okay. I went over to the Apple store. They said, Drive Savers was good. I had done some online search and so forth. And I'm like, I don't know. This is likely to be very expensive. So, you know, as you know, we're kind of amateur photographers, and I'd been doing a lot of editing of photos and so forth. And so, you know, stuff's valuable, all of this from when she was zero on, you know, to her current age. So we could do the Drive Saver. I called them. Had written to four companies. They were the most responsive. They actually for a holiday. And two of the other companies were about like a week delay to even get back to me. So with Apple's recommendation, I figured, okay, I'll pack up and send it off. And through all this, I'm very optimistic. This is going to work. So yes, they did get the Drive. Looks like not a big problem. Then there's a phone call after an email. Can we have a little bit more time? Take as much time as you need. And I see this one day in between seeing folks, and I get a call from California. And it's those calls that I'm sure all of us have had at some point where it's this long pause. And they said, well, it was a catastrophic failure, and it was an incomplete they could only get an incomplete image of the disk, and maybe saving out 200 gigabytes of data. Like, well, all right, something is better than nothing. So we pulled the trigger, and they did their thing. And I get the drive back, and still optimistic. Maybe this has current stuff. I have to cobble together some of the older things and open up the files, and there was precious little of anything in there.
Yikes.
Yeah, it was really kind of a sinking feeling. You know, as I was thinking about our get together today, we can manufacture so much data that at some point some of the data really isn't worthwhile. So there were some just like pictures in there. And it seemingly I got most of those junk pictures back, you know, things that Zoe had put in there, like, you know, pictures of unicorns and things like that. It would have been okay to have lost, right? But the real projects were kind of gone. And I'm like, oh, God, you have to be kidding me. $1,650 later.
Oh, ow.
Yeah, ouch, big ouch. So I must have a very nice Buffalo external hard drive that I really kind of like. So on a lark, I said, you know, I do have Time Machine. I moved this thing off.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved the Aperture Library off to the external drive, the Thunderbolt drive, and maybe there's an old copy. So I go back, and they go back. Sure enough, I must have moved it in February of last year, and lo and behold, there was a full copy of Aperture. So I bring that forward, 680 gigs of information, and boom, there's most of the photo library.
All right, so everything but everything but the most recent stuff, right? At that point, it looks
right.
Okay.
Right. So. My daughter goes to school in California, so we go up. We usually take an extra week or so. I'd been doing some shooting in San Francisco, Golden Gate Bridge, all of those sorts of things. And I really like some of the images that I got, and of course, they're not there.
Sure.
Neither were a week-long class that Zoe and I had actually taken with a notable photographer who was in town, and all of that was gone. But I had taken the CF card, and when I put it into Aperture, I'd also thrown some of those off onto another drive, and lo and behold, at least I had the most recent San Francisco pictures.
Nice.
And some are up in iCloud, because I shared those with some friends, and so it didn't lose absolutely everything, but it was really quite a loss.
Yeah.
It certainly was, my optimism was evaporated, let's put it that way. There's some hard realities in there that when these things do go bad, they can be really bad.
Right.
Perhaps dodging the bullet that I didn't lose 450 gigabytes of data, that would have been gone. But I still, it was sober, let's put it that way. So that's the sort of long story of
it. Yeah, so just to clarify for myself, so, boy, there's so many things happened. We start with a Thunderbolt problem where Thunderbolt's kind of flaky. And that basically takes your Drobo offline, so that's your multi-drive, you know, redundant system. And mm-hmm. then your USB, a Buffalo drive, did you say? Your USB, I assume it's UFB, or is it FireWire or something else, but or Thunderbolt? But
The Buffalo drive was what the Disk Savers returned the...
What they came back on, okay.
In the interim, because it's now really do need to pay attention to back here,
yeah.
I got online this was around Thanksgiving, so it was a Black Friday Cyber Monday. I bought 5 external drives to start stashing all sorts of kinds of stuff in.
Right.
I was so happy when Amazon box came. I was like, oh, I look like a store. It was unreal. So,
okay. So, anyway. So the good news though is that you didn't lose like everything to the beginning of time through a variety of sources, including an old time machine backup, CF cards, some stuff in the cloud, and the drive recovery service. So it sounds like you've covered, what do you think, 60, 70%, maybe more?
I think the drive recovery folks probably 22%.
Uh-huh.
And then through all the other places where I stash stuff, I think I probably have 85% back.
That's great.
80.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not great, but it's better than it could have been, better than 0%.
and better than the 200 and some odd that came back, because that was really old stuff, which is very valuable, but not in the newer photo projects.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. What's the lessons learned from your point? I mean, again, you had a lot of stuff going on that most of us don't have. You have a Drobo and all this stuff. And
one of the
go ahead, John.
One of the questions I had was you mentioned, Warren, that you'd use CrashPlan and we mentioned that briefly. But where was CrashPlan kind of in all of this? The cloud backup, destination, I guess.
I actually, and CrashPlan was very helpful. I had lots of phone calls and emails back and forth with them. I actually was able to get a good chunk of it down, but it was not new enough to have some of the things that I discovered on Time Machine. The problem with the cloud stuff that you guys are much more aware of than I am is that it's just slow uploading it. And I had sent a seeded drive to them from Zoe's photo work. She's also quite a photographer. And they cannot take raw data. So we shoot in raw, and they would not use that as seed, which it was disappointing. CrashPlan was... very helpful for download restoration of that was not so bad.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. That's a really interesting tidbit of information. I mean, most of us would not think about file types as being sort of rejected seed files. So if you're a serious photographer shooting in RAW format, you're kind of out of luck with what's generally speaking a very highly regarded backup, a cloud backup service.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. kind of what I was thinking, because I use CrashPlan, and I think at last count I have something like 1.5 terabytes or so uploaded to CrashPlan, and I have them all on it's basically a bunch of external disks that are being fed into my home server that they're on, but I've never seen any report of, you know, these files didn't back up. Now, I don't shoot in RAW, but I'm starting to think I have a couple of cameras that can shoot in RAW that I should pull on and just play around and see if it'll back that up. But
yeah,
that is an interesting thing I've never seen in any of CrashPlan's documentation, that file size makes a difference, or file. Although maybe it's just for if you are sending them a seed hard drive versus if it's on your computer or something like that.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing, too, is even if it didn't take it as a seed, it means that when, you know, after Warren sent the seed drive in and they, you know, they kind of fired up the base system and then he started uploading via the cloud, it apparently didn't take that either. Does that sound about right, Warren?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that kind of blows the whole.
It's.
Go ahead.
No, you're on track with it. Keep going.
Yeah, I was going to say, it kind of blows away the whole theory that, you know, as an off-site part, you know, so everybody says, okay, do you need the basics of backup are three copies of everything, one off-site, and on a different kind of media. And the off-site these days is usually thought of as cloud backup. But, you know, different kinds of cloud backup, for example, the other popular one, Carbonite. Carbonite only backs up your C drive if you're on a Windows machine. I don't know what it does on a Mac. Probably just the main drive. So, you know, if you're...
Main drive.
Yeah, so if you're storing stuff on another drive, like, you know, all your photos, because it's too big for your main drive, that's what I do, it will never back up. And a limitation for CrashPlan is if you're doing RAW files, apparently, you know, that's a possible problem.
Now, this is... It's interesting because I'm doing a quick search on this and I'm finding code 42 employees saying that CrashPlan does support RAW.
Hmm.
And so it seems to be that there's some sort of there's definitely discussion on if it supports, if it's not supported.
Hmm.
But there is something that there, if you are a professional photographer or semi-pro, you would want to make sure that whatever the answer to this question is, you know it if you're using CrashPlan.
Yeah.
Because it looks like, and the discussions I'm looking at are from 2012, basically saying that RAW should be supported, but others saying that when they restore them, they're not coming back as RAW, they're coming back in XMP format and a few other things.
Interesting, which is similar to what Warren's seen. Not exactly the same, but you know, basically it's not what he sent. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So you got it. It took a while because I know the last time I spoke with you, you still had not gotten your drive back. So how long did the whole recovery process take? Was it about a month?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we didn't get it back until the week of Christmas.
Wow. Okay.
So it was a long, long.
Okay, so now that you've gone through this whole process, I was going to say we, because I kind of feel like I did too, having listened to this story for a while.
Yes.
but having gone through this process now where, you know, you had a backup plan, which for most of us, anybody would say, that was a good backup plan. You had cloud, you had a Drobo, you had Time Machine. Most of us say that's not just sufficient, but more than just sufficient. You know, that's what all the experts say, right? What are you doing now to, you know, now that you've learned all this, you've recovered about 80-something% of your valuable photographs. What's the plan going forward?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good question. I guess there's several levels. At some point, I think I'm going to need to take my iMac over to the Apple store because it's still throwing off, prematurely ejecting another Thunderbolt drive. And so I could be a bit worried. So that's one piece. The other really has to do with a clearer view on my part of what do I put onto all these drives. So if I just throw things onto them as sort of a bucket, do I have some other structure in there for things that are really very, very important? So I'm just not backing up terabyte after terabyte of data. The plan at this point is to keep some PDF files on what files make a PDF file of then all of the files that are on these drives, and then take the various external drives that have been sort of buckets I've thrown things into, and put that data into 2 4-terabyte drives, including the most important stuff off of the drive, and then make yet again another drive off of those, and take those probably to the office.
Yeah, off-site for your off-site plan. Yeah,
yeah, and I think using carbon cleaner to help make that happen a little bit easier for syncing and so forth. It's to me it's a little bit labor intensive. This is all the stuff of, you know, things they know that you need to do and you should do. It all makes good sense, but it's the stuff like, you know, sitting down and editing some photos. But it's really hygienic, and I'll need to do some discipline around that to make sure it happens. Irony upon irony, the drive that the now prized Time Machine stuff lived on. And so I was able to clone that drive onto a 4-terabyte drive. However, the way that I cloned it, it has taken 2 terabytes of data, and it now only somehow the 4-terabyte drive only will hold that cloned Thunderbolt drive. So I have some other steps in there to try to get a little bit thinner and get that onto a 2-terabyte drive, so that then Time Machine will keep making even a longer and longer and longer set of backups. And hopefully I can get some of these drives off of my desk. I have then my wife's machine to do this, which I still have practice information on. And then trying to keep up with Zoe's machine also. And her Aperture library is 1.7 terabytes. And so I keep a redundant copy here. She takes another hard drive back to California with her, but trying to keep those things linked up be a bit of a challenge, because when she's shooting, she does a lot. Works very rapidly in her shutter. She'll do photo shoots and do 300-400 images in one shoot.
Yeah. You know, this brings up a really fascinating problem that I've been trying to wrestle with slowly over time. And that's this, you know, when we think about backup, I'm speaking in a generic sense. When generally people think about backup, I think most of us still think we're back in the 1990s. I know I do when I think about it. You know, we think about days when a backup really was only a couple of megabytes, right? Something that would fit with on a flash drive with room to spare. But back then, you know, I remember Windows, not Windows, but the IBM XT came with a 10 megabyte hard drive. 10 right. megabytes. And, you know, back then it was hard to back up because we had to use, you know, little 320K floppies, and that took forever. But at some point it became relatively easy, you know, when we could start burning CDR disks and then later DVD-RW disks. And I remember I used to back up my photos once a month to a CD until I started shooting more than 600 megabytes a month. And then I said, well, I'll save it to a DVD. But then I thought, man, I'm starting to accumulate a bunch of these 5 gigabyte or 4.7 gigabyte DVDs. I gave up on that idea. Then I started buying USB drives every 6 months. Every time Costco has a sale, I'd go buy a drive and start, you know, making backups of stuff. But but the truth is, you know, as we get larger and larger files, you know, especially people like you who shoot not just gigabytes, but terabytes of photos. And I can only imagine what the videographer type hobbyists must deal with. You know, they shoot. It's become.
I played around with this.
Go ahead.
I played around with this Sony camera. I played around with a Sony camera, a really pretty sweet camera that shoots 4K video. And, you know, I have no idea what those files are. I'm not much into video. And Zoe took a camera with her to Africa that shoots 4K video also. So, you know, it's just more data that gets manufactured easily.
Yeah, and it becomes harder and harder to back up because, you know, you're talking about 3 and 4 terabyte hard drives, and that's kind of not enough for what mm-hmm. you yes. need.
Yeah.
And right. that's...
What would be perfect... What would be perfect is if I had like a 10 terabyte hard drive, I could buy two of them, do some sort of thing where it's just, you know, making syncing and syncing then across and bringing a drive every weekend from the office. But, you know, we're not there yet.
Yeah.
And so speaking of, you know, office, offsite. My only concern, I did that for a while before I kind of got everything kind of consolidated down to crash plan and on my home server. And I've had a few things where I've had to restore, and I've been pretty happy with my fail safes, but nothing is ever truly fail safe. But the office plan that I always worried about was if I leave my hard drive in my office and anyone were to get access to my office, it's fairly easy for them to snoop that drive pretty well unless I have it fully encrypted. You know, there's computers all around my office, so, you know, they could just grab the drive. The cleaning person could grab the drive, go over, plug it in. So then you're kind of worried about how's the security of my data and all of that. Mm-hmm. So that's... It's weird how when you start thinking about your backup strategy, all of these other contingencies and worries come in. But going back to your earlier point, Todd, about kind of our conceptions of backup, it really became real to me, or at least I first felt the icy chill of not having data, which is, you know, that moment, and Warren, I'm sure you've felt this, where, you know, you get that kind of, oh my God, and a tremor just kind of goes through you of I've lost something. That when I was doing technical consulting, you know, back in the early 2000s, I worked for a web hosting company, and, you know, we would lose something. We'd lose customer data. We'd lose email data because our backups had failed or something screwy had happened. We were running Windows web servers, and they could be screwy on their own. And it's just, you get that pit of your stomach, visceral, oh my God, what's happening sort of feeling. So I definitely empathize with you and encourage anyone who does not know what they're doing for a backup to do something before they get that exact same feeling.
Yeah, and I guess the scary thing is, you know, you really got to do your homework. If all you have are Word files and, you know, the occasional JPEG photos from your little iPhone or something, it's probably not too bad. But if you're a serious photographer or videographer and you're using maybe specialized file formats or just gigantic file formats like RAW, which is both special and gigantic, you want to do your homework. Make sure your backup plan is actually backing it up. Because, you know, a lot of these, like I said, a lot of these backup systems do have exceptions to the rule. You know, you can't back up certain drives. You can't back up certain kinds of files. It's a lot trickier than I think most of us think of, and, you know, kind of a very shallow surface kind of way when we think about these things.
Yeah. So certainly that sinking feeling is, you know, very much a sinking feeling. You know, when they said it was an incomplete backup, like, you know, oh my God, you know, this is, I'm not going to be able to come back from this. And the additional part is that of the loss was not only the images themselves, but and I enjoy doing this, so I'm looking forward to going back and doing more editing on the photos. But a lot of the photos were all edited. I run through lots of filters and so forth and clean them up and hopefully make them look pretty. And so all that work was gone. So I wanted to just add one other thing.
Sure.
So the one reason I like is that it would take that are hooked into the main computer. That I thought was cool. And then, you know, I'm a practicing psychologist, both my wife and I are. And so our data sits in the cloud, and we have to be very careful with HIPAA compliance for that. And so, now that's, I'm just saying what we use, Spider Oak is typically compliant. And so all the stuff is up in those, in that server. Mm-hmm. But that would be spreadsheets and financials and patient information and so forth. So there's even yet again one other level to consider, depending on the type of data that you have. And I share your concern, John, that you know, the hard drive in the office, somebody can walk away with it, and not only knows what could happen. So,
yeah. And then, yeah, the whole physical security aspect that, you know, used to be the only really security most people thought about is now something people maybe don't. So that becomes an interesting problem. And, you know, both of our daughters are in dorms in their respective colleges, and, you know, that's a whole nother that's a whole nother set of security problems.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and you bring up a good point with, you know, things like HIPAA. And I'm a research psychologist, and I've got a lot of, you know, participant data and things that fall under FERPA for my students and IRB data guidelines and everything else. So it is really interesting when you are in a profession where you sort of hard mediation that work and home, and so you've got the dual edge of if I lose something, not only could I potentially be very upset about it, but others could be very potentially upset about it as well. So it's a lot of things to think about these days.
Yeah, that's right. It's not just losing data, but how you lose it and what condition it's in when you lose it, if it's encrypted or, you know, whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and for the FERPA and HIPAA, et cetera, there are pretty stiff fines that go along with that if to due diligence, which is concerning as well.
Yeah. Well, listen, Warren, thank you again for taking the time to tell us the story, because, you know, even if John and I are the only people listening to podcasts, and that's not true, we do have three or four other people. Now we have about, I don't know, about some of our podcasts hit about 200, I think. But
cool.
Even if John and I were the only two people who hear this story, it's valuable to me. I mean, I learned a lot about, you know, about the details that I hadn't asked you about earlier, and you know, giving me pause for thought about now, you know, is what I'm doing enough? The answer is no, by the way. and what's next, you know? And I don't shoot in RAW, so that's – I do have some RAW files, but generally I shoot in JPEG like, you know, like most amateur photographers. So it's not a problem for me. You know, I'm not a serious amateur photographer. And but I mean, you know, I don't want to lose those photos. I mean, shooting those photos with my daughter since she was a baby, and you know, those things may not have value to anybody else, but they have a lot of value to me. So I need to rethink about what I've done now, having learned what you've done. And you know, again, you know, to reiterate to people listening to this, he had a cloud backup plan. He had a multi-drive redundant system that's highly regarded, Drobo. He had, you know, a time machine, as well as some cloud and, you know, ancillary devices like compact flashcards and so forth. And yet, something happened. And it all started with, oddly enough, something most people don't think about. And that's a problem with Thunderbolt on the Mac. It's an interesting set of problems, kind of the perfect storm kind of problem that occurred to you, unfortunately. And also that, you know, drive recovery firms, as good as some of them are, you know, they can't work miracles. They can only work with what they have. And if what they have is a catastrophic failure, as they told you, you know, they're not going to get everything back. So the story is, don't depend on. Go ahead, John.
And I'll echo the same kind of sentiment. I appreciate coming out and telling us this. And, you know, personally, for me, right, doing it is my crash plan backup window from my server, making sure it's running smoothly. And I guess, you know, you can have the best laid plans and then they start to get off track. I've seen this, you know, in the consulting world as well, where the backup was working fine up until March.
And it's now December, and we March because no one checked on it. When I set up a few protocols for the first level techs at the company I was consulting with, that was it. It was a weekly check to make sure the backup scripts are actually running and things are actually up where they're supposed to be.
Right.
And the same thing that goes for all of us. If you have things like CrashPlan, occasionally pretend that you just lost a set of files and you need to restore it and make sure that that can be restored. Or you know, you do not want to have that icy chill feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I've got a lot to think about this weekend. Thanks again, Warren, and we'll
okay.
We'll talk to folks later. This has been Mobile Views Podcast number 107, and we should have done this on Halloween, maybe, because it was a really scary story. It was really scary to me, but it had a semi happy ending. He got 80-something% back of his. Of his, you know, photos, which you can't get anywhere else. So, any rate, MobileViews 107. Maybe we'll have something less scary next week. Thanks, everyone.
Ooh.